Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios, well, I guess Northeast and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 184 of Registry Matters. The humidity here, Larry, is just so very different than it is in Georgia. It is so different. They might think that it's humid up here, but boy, do they have another thing coming. It's kind of funny.
What's the humidity there as we speak?
I bet it's 40%. But 40%, even still, it's not the same because it's quote-unquote relative humidity. Like 100%, 90% in New Orleans is not 90% in Georgia and is not 90% in Pittsburgh. Not even close to the same.
So, well, I sent you a screenshot of ours. What was it yesterday? Like 14% or something?
Probably. I didn't look at that. I saw that you said it was like 104 or something like that. It's crazy. That's like, I don't know. That's hot. All right. Now that we're done with the FYP weather forecast podcast, let us begin this show. Tell us, Larry, what do we have this evening?
A fantastic program lined up. We have a comment from a listener. We have at least three or maybe four questions. We have West Virginia Supreme Court ruling analyzed by a West Virginian. And we have a Colorado Court of Appeals decision related to PFRs and prohibition and limitations on internet access. It should be exciting.
Wow. That's all. Man, are we going to be able to fit all this in an hour?
If you talk fast.
Okay, I will talk very fast. Let's start from a very longtime patron and pretty regular contributor, from Will from Tennessee, if I recall. I haven't talked to Will in a long time. I almost forget where he's from. If this decision, this is from what we talked about a week or two ago, if this decision that lifetime registration stands, wouldn't the state be able to cherry pick an expert who would come in on the stand to swear up and down every applicant for deregistration would be too dangerous to let go? Can't the state simply get a paid hack to say anything they want? This sounds conspiratorial, Larry.
Yeah, the funny thing is, it's not so ridiculous. It very well could happen. What he's talking about is the South Carolina Supreme Court saying that you cannot be required to register for life without some due process to evaluate your continued need to register. And therefore, South Carolina is going to end up having to create a process to remove folks from the registry. And that would be one thing that would very likely happen, would be that there would be an opponent. Remember, when you file these deregistration petitions, you serve them on a party, which is usually the prosecuting attorney in the jurisdiction of conviction. But that is a part of the prosecution apparatus. And when you're talking about the state, that's who you'd be referring to. It would be very likely that the more affluent counties, particularly that have lots of PFRs, they would be able to easily bring someone in that would say that. That's all the more reason why, if I were advising South Carolina, which they haven't asked me for any advice, I would try to rewrite the statutory scheme where the Tier 1s and the Tier 2s do not even need to file a petition because they're not required to by federal law. That was just South Carolina overreach, putting everyone at lifetime when they didn't even have to do that to have their precious AWA compliance. I would rewrite the law and make sure those people just termed out automatically without having to file anything. Then you've gotten rid of two-thirds of the people in the registry that they would theoretically no longer be entitled to have a removal process because they removed themselves. Then you would be down to the one-third, and then I would look at that one-third that's Tier 3 and make sure that we didn't have anybody in that category that didn't need to be by the federal standards, and then I'd create a process for those people if it were me and I were creating this. But I don't expect them to do that. I expect them to require everybody to file a petition, and that's more of the reason why they're not going to want to do it, because it's going to be far more expensive when you have to give everyone a petition process.
As opposed to something that we've talked about, I think, is why not just make it automatic after X number of years, whether that be 10 years, that you just fall off automatically?
That's what the federal law permits.
That is permitted in the AWA guidelines?
Absolutely.
But I don't think there's a state that does it.
I think there are a few. We don't have a petition process, but most people here are stuck for life. But the ones who are less than life, they just fall off. They don't need to file anything.
Oh, okay.
But under the AWA, these very rigid federal regulations to achieve your precious substantial compliance designation, petitions are not needed. And I've said that over and over again. You can just let them term out. And that's what I would do if I were fixing South Carolina's problem. I would say, look, I'm pretending I'm Attorney General and I'm a policymaker there. We can't afford to be having all these hearings for 14,000 people. So what we're going to do is we're going to skirt not having to have a hearing because we're going to let these people just time out. They won't need to file a petition. Then that just took care of a big part of the Supreme Court's concern, because their concern was that no one gets off, that everyone is on for life. So therefore, I just took care of 2/3 of the registry. They're no longer on for life. They just simply time out. And then we would deal with that remaining third, look at that list critically and make sure that they really do have to be Tier 3, because a lot of states are fond of putting people in Tier 3, those offenses that don't have to be. And I would move those out of Tier 3 and down to Tier 2, and maybe Tier 1, but I would certainly drop them down to Tier 2. And then I would figure out how to develop a less costly process for the remaining people, because then you've reduced the number of people, and you've cut the expense by 2/3.
Right. Larry, you and your rational reasoning and making sense of things, I don't like it.
Well, that's the way that you can sell this, because there'd be less likely that they would fight it. I continue to believe that they will file a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, because they're faced with creating a process for 14,000. I think it's Don said, the South Carolina advocate,
right.
14,000 people. They're not going to want to do that. That's going to be very expensive, and they're not going to want to do that.
Right. But if they just had a fall-off process, it wouldn't be expensive.
That's what I just said. That's why I would recommend letting the people term off the registry, and you've reduced that cost dramatically.
Sure. Okay, well, let's move on. We have yet like another email message, a voicemail message from Brent. This is like the third in a series, I think. Do we need to set this up or just let it play?
Well, it's the arrest of a relative, and they're both college students, and I don't know the extent of how close they are, but a family member, and he's been reaching out to me directly for feedback because we have come to know each other through the podcast.
Okay. Well, here we go with Brent's voicemail.
Hey, Andy and Larry. Hello again. I just wanted to give kudos to FYP for all the help that you've provided to my family and I since my relative was arrested by the FBI. So far, the entire process has gone down literally exactly the way that Larry said it would. But unfortunately, the detention hearing did not go well, and the judge ordered him detained pending trial. So this is, hit our family pretty hard, because they literally had no idea how the system worked. I had, some idea by listening to you guys, but they were completely blindsided. They're also pretty shocked that the federal sentencing guidelines are so strict, and that his offense that he's charged with has a mandatory sentence that can't be suspended. So, which pretty much means automatic jail time. Anyway, I'll keep FYP informed as it unfolds. But also on a side note, that was a sick laugh track. Do you know who that is laughing? I've never heard that one before.
Do you want to cover the back part first?
Well, let's hear the laugh track. I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing.
No, I can't do it. I don't have my gear with me. I'm traveling.
All right. Well, I think he means sick is good, right? Sick laugh track. That would be good, right?
That would be the modern day term. I think the easiest way to explain it would be what, like in the 80s and 90s, what the term bad was. So you'd say, man, that was bad, but that meant good. So sick is like awesome, good, killer. Off the charts.
So, all right. Well, what am I supposed to be explaining now?
I guess that was, we were explaining that part, but was there anything to follow up with the whole process that they're going through with the federal sentencing guidelines?
Well, on a side communication, he asked me what would be the chances of this case being dismissed. And I told him very, very low. I mean, exceedingly low. If it were in the state system, there'd be a higher chance, but even in the state system, the chances would be low. What makes a case like this, and this is possession and distribution of CP, what makes a case like this so different is you have multiple witnesses. A case with an individual victim can completely fall apart without the victim. It can completely fall apart without a key detective. Someone gets transferred to a rack or somewhere, and they're crucial to the case. The case falls apart. This case isn't likely to fall apart because there's too many agencies involved in it. There's the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children who provided the initial tip. Then there's the FBI. Then there's the Department of Homeland Security. There's the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department. There's on and on with agencies involved. And there's not a key witness that would make this case go away that's so critical that it, and plus there's been a confession. I've seen the evidence in the case in terms of the affidavit for the arrest, there's a confession. So then you would have to be successful on a suppression motion. And there's just too much that'll make this case impossible for it to go away. Now, I mean, could there be a presidential pardon? I mean, we've heard of people being pardoned before they're convicted. I mean, we heard of that in the Trump administration. We heard of we've heard of
Arpaio.
we've heard about that in the Nixon administration, actually after the Nixon administration. But yeah, that is possible, but it's a very long shot that any of that would happen. I don't see President Biden issuing a pardon preemptively on this case. So therefore, it's not likely to go away. So it's going to be pled out. If it's not pled out, if he were to go to trial, he would get a horrendous sentence. So it's going to be pled out. That's the way
Gotcha.
that's the way this case will go.
That's just terrible. Okay, I think enough of that, and we can move on to a follow-up message. This is the follow-up show, a follow-up message from Jeff.
Happy Saturday, Registry Matters. This is Jeff from Kentucky again. Last week, Larry said about my other question about the South Carolina thing and lifetime registration without due process. He didn't know how long I had been on the registry. I've been on for 5 years, and I had 2 counts possession, 1 count distribution, and distribution sounds really bad, but it was simply that a cop was able to download it from me. Therefore, I got distribution. But they all three stemmed from one incident. I have not been adjudicated 3 separate times. It was all one incident. So if you would, explain to me what due process is and pretend I'm really dumb, if you would, and explain to me how I did or did not receive due process by being put on the registry for life with no chance of getting off. And as always, FYP. And thank you for what you guys do. Take care. Bye.
Interesting. Jeff's a longtime listener forever, pretty much like since episode one, practically, and a longtime Patreon supporter as well.
Fantastic. Well, due process, there's procedural and there's substantive due process, and he's talking about procedural due process here. When there's a liberty interest going to be diminished, there has to be a process as prescribed and followed by law. The problem that he's talking about is we do not know what due process is for this issue and what suffices. What we're learning from these court decisions is that the lack of any process is problematic, but we won't know what due process. When South Carolina creates its process, we won't know until it's tested in court if that is sufficient due process. The states, up until recently, when they started losing these cases, they simply argued that when you were adjudicated through the criminal system that resulted in your conviction, that that in and of itself was due process. But where that started breaking down was that at the time many people were adjudicated, that either there was no registry or it was far less onerous, far more benign. And then as time has passed, like the registration periods on point two and point three versions of the registry and point four, as they continue to toughen it, they include so many more disabilities or restraints. So the courts have started to recognize that perhaps maybe you did receive due process if the registry existed in some form or fashion at the time of your original conviction. But what you signed up for in your original plea negotiations as a registry, that was the point one version. We're now on point four, and you could not have reasonably anticipated all these disabilities and restraints. So therefore, to continue to extract more and more of your freedom and impose more and more restraints on your liberty, that you're going to have some form of due process that justifies that. We don't know what it'll look like. We truly don't know. We've had decisions out of other courts. I remember New Hampshire, I think, was the first Supreme Court that came out with such a decision 5-6 years ago. They said that the person had to have due process. They didn't know what it looked like because they're the court. They're not the ones who make the law and create the process. They just said that you need to create a process. Well, when South Carolina creates it, if they decide not to file a cert petition, we will look at that. And some of us will say, gee, that's not sufficient, or we'll say that's pretty good due process. And if it's challenged, we'll have to take that up on appeal and find out if it satisfies the opportunity to be heard, to confront the evidence that's against you, to put in evidence on your behalf, and so forth and so on, all things that are part of due process. But right now, we don't know.
Okay. Interesting. All right. I guess we can go over to the thing we have titled of To Be Read. And I'm going to read the whole thing, Larry?
You can. I don't think it'll take too long if you don't mind.
No. No, I don't mind. I was just making sure because, I mean, it is semi-long. All right. My friend Sean is a subscriber to the Registry Matters transcripts. He is the young man who has dual citizenship with the UK and wants to leave the US when his sentence is over. He's written 2 or 3 times, I believe. Actually, you might call me his silent partner, but with respect to being 2 subscribers. When he was on the fence about paying so much for a subscription, and let's face it, a prison salary is a bit, prison salary, it is a bit hefty. Oh, on a prison salary, though I completely understand the need to cover costs on your end. I said I'd buy his coffee bags for a few months. This way, effectively, we both paid for half a year subscription and share the full year's informative podcast. It's a scheme that works well for us, and I think more folks in prison should strike similar deals. Totally, Larry. People could, like, 5, 10, 20 people could all chip in and then be, you know, a couple of soups or something for one person to pay for it. People trade coffee, noodles, stamps, and other items all the time for useless garbage like meat legs and cookies. Meat bags? Something like that. Why not pull in with each other to share a podcast transcript subscription and learn some valuable information? Oh, well. If everyone took time to think about how we'd all be better off working together, maybe we'd actually be living in a utopian society without prisons in the first place. So, considering the context of where we are, I encourage others to try sharing subscriptions, and maybe a few genuinely will. Regardless, this is not the reason I'm writing. I'm interested in a topic you addressed in the 12 June podcast, Janice J. Powell versus Mark Keel, Chief State Law Enforcement Division, at the 2nd State of South Carolina. Without going into too much detail, I was sentenced for a similar crime, and although I ultimately took a plea deal, I have always wondered how the state could feel so confident in pressing charges when, in my text with the undercover officer, I repeatedly indicated either we would engage in nothing sexual when we met, or I expressed ambivalence about my intentions. Ultimately, the police arrested me several blocks away when I chose not to park my car and go to the building we'd agreed to meet at. You indicate you've done a lot of work on this subject for all 50 states. I'd be interested in reading the material you mentioned, especially for the state of Wisconsin. How much would you ask me to pay? I probably don't need to read that. Obviously, I'd like to fight back for my own benefit, yet I want to stand up for others too. When I'm released in 2 years, I will advocate and fight for better laws, until meaningful change is solidly established. Thank you both, Larry and Andy, for all you do. Enclosed are some envelopes to help your work. I wish it could be more. Thank you so much. Wow, that's a lot going on there. What do you think about the work being done in all 50 states? Where do you want to go with that one?
Well, I was actually thinking I had divided that up. I thought I had the one to be read, and then we're going to do the question later, but they're combined.
Oh.
So what? That's why you thought it was longer than I thought it was, because I was seeing it as a one-pager. But, and the Wisconsin law, now I have not updated this for nearly a decade, and I'll be happy to provide it to him without any cost. I'll send him the compilation. But what they had at the time I did this, Wisconsin had 2 statutes. One was 948.07, was child enticement. And the other statute, I think, is more relevant, 948-075, use of a computer to facilitate a child sex crime. And that one, it read at the time I did this, whoever uses a computerized communication system to communicate with an individual who the actor believes or has reason to believe has not attained the age of 16 with intent to have sexual contact or sexual intercourse with the individual in violation of section 948.02, 1 or 2 is guilty of a Class C felony. Now, that's a pretty well-constructed statute. It's not the best, but it's a pretty well-constructed statute because the actor has to believe that the person has not attained 16 years of age and there has to be intent to have sexual contact or sexual intercourse as that statute stood when I did this research. And therefore, I would say that not knowing the facts of that particular case, that even though he didn't park and maybe he got cold feet, that they probably had some evidence of intent to have sex. And they had evidence that he knew or believed that the actor was under age of 16. So it was a cop posing, not a real person. It never is a real person. But I have a feeling that the evidence was there that he had intent. They always come with, this is a family program, but they always come with condoms. They always come prepared for sexual intercourse. And then what would have happened when they arrested him, they would have asked him, after reading him his rights, because they would have arrested him, told him he was in custody, they would have asked him, did he wish to talk and discuss that? And they would have asked him, what would he have done had they not arrested him? Would he have had sex? And during that interview, if any time he said, I might would have, they would have embellished that in their report, and they would have said that he agreed that he would have sexual intercourse with that person posing as a minor. So therefore, I feel his pain, but Wisconsin statute wasn't that bad at the time in terms of, I wish all the state statutes were as clear and as clean as this one was written at that time. I'll look up a current version of it. We'll talk about it in a future episode, but I doubt it has changed significantly.
Do you think, I mean, like the act of, I don't know if you could even extend it back, but as soon as you got in the car and started driving towards, wouldn't that almost be, I'm pushing it all the way to the extreme. He parked a block away. How far away would you be before you have not done the intent part? If you got in the car and started and headed in that direction, you've got the intent if you want to push it all the way.
Well, not necessarily. If you had not discussed previously, you have the right to meet someone without having sex if that hasn't been discussed in advance of the proposed meeting. But I suspect that there was a discussion about sex might occur. The person posing as a minor said, well, you know, anything can happen. Yeah, I think older guys are cute or whatever they say. But the actual, what you usually would have in what scenario you're describing is an attempt. When you take, like, say, for example, he agreed, or the conversation, the text, or the whatever way they were conversing, suggested that sex might happen, and then he took the step of driving and moving towards that individual's location, then you've got a substantial step in furtherance of completion of the act. And that is generally considered an attempt because the police don't have to let the person fall in if they really had been a minor. They don't have to let the minor fall into the hands of the perp and see if they would actually have sex. That first step towards meeting, if there had been discussion of sex, would be sufficient in most instances to complete what would be an attempt, which normally drops the offense by one level of severity. But still, I feel your pain, but I don't think you have anything. Now, there went the rest of our subscription. Now they're going to cancel the rest of it.
Yeah, no more bags of coffee going to the person that's actually paying for it to defray the cost. So maybe you should give them positive news, Larry, instead of all the negative Nancy stuff.
Well, I'm going to send him this compilation.
Oh, okay. Well, good reaching out there, Larry. Okay, then let's move over to question number one. And this says, to whom this may concern. I'm writing in regards to some questions concerning the PFR registry and federal supervised release, etc., and I hope you're able to help. I've been hearing that there are people, advocates, fighting to get rid of the registry or reform it. Is there any truth to this? It's a very vicious thing. Also regarding polygraphs, I've heard the same thing, that advocates are fighting to get rid of using them on supervised release. Is this true? There are people that have been violated and sent back to federal prison for failed polygraphs, for technical stuff, and to be honest, that concerns me. And my last question is, I'm from New York, but would like to move to Vermont upon release. Will I be able to move to Vermont when I get released from the feds? How is it living there as a PFR in regards to the laws, etc.? I've heard it's one of the better states to live in as a PFR. Any and all info you're able to send me will be appreciated so very much. Thank you for all your time and help in this matter, and look forward to hearing back from you. Best regards, Chad, maybe? Something like that.
Okay. This comes from a prison where we have a lot of support for both the newsletter and the podcast. I'm always going to go out of my way to be helpful because we have such loyal followers at that particular prison. So there are a lot of questions here. Is it true that people are working, advocates are working on both of those things to deal with polygraph? Yes. Are they going to succeed? Well, that's another question.
Maybe.
getting rid of polygraphs as they pertain to treatment, probably not likely. I just don't see that happen. So there went bad news number one. There was like a second question at the beginning there, wasn't there?
I hear that there are people, advocates, fighting to get rid of the registry or reform it. So that one is true.
Then regarding
the polygraphs.
Yeah.
Then also, go ahead.
Yeah, the getting rid of the registry, there are people advocating for that or making it non-public. That's going to be a really, really long shot because it's ingrained in American society now. It's been around some variation since the mid-1990s. So we're talking about 25 years. Americans will tell you now that they have a right to know, because if you have something for that long, it becomes ingrained. They have the right to know this information. So taking away something that they see as a right is going to be difficult through a political process. Could it be done through a court process? Maybe. If we can prove how punitive being on a website is and all the things related to registry, but merely collecting a name of people, putting them on a list of registry, there's nothing punitive about that. We do that for voters. We do that for young men who register for the draft. We do that for the children of Flint that were exposed to contaminated water. I mean, we register. That doesn't have to punish you. So you could have a sexual offender registry that would not inflict any punishment. That would be conceivable to concoct such a mechanism. As far as rolling these things back, it's a tough sell politically. It's really tough.
Which kind of means why we have to take it to court, though, to get the judges to push back to say that, no, you can't. But they're not going to say what they can do. So then they can just step up to that line again and do everything, but not that one little thing or two little things.
And we have to quit expecting the judges to know by divine intervention that the registry is punitive. We have to be prepared with big bucks to come in with witnesses, with experts, with testimony, and we need to stop doing summary judgment. We need to put these cases on trial with a strong evidentiary record below so that the judges can make those decisions. That's what we need to do. And that means that we're going to have to, as a population, we're going to have to stop waiting for someone else, and we're going to have to dig into our pockets, and we're going to have to contribute, and we're going to have to be supportive of those who are fighting these battles because they are very expensive. Now, they're with the rest of our listeners.
So there are people that have been violated and sent back to federal prison for failed polygraphs. But see, cover that for a second. People don't fail, quote unquote. They don't fail the polygraph. They just have some level of, that didn't quite look right. So then let's go scrutinize you further.
Yeah, I continue to take issue with that because the failing the polygraph, showing deception, doesn't send you back to prison. In most instances, it's your admission after the polygraph conclusion and the post-polygraph interview where disclosures are made. Those send you back to prison. But just simply showing deception, if you continue to say, I told the truth, I have not seen a revocation petition yet, and I'm going to have to up the ante. Please send me a petition that says only that that's all they did, show deception on a polygraph. Send me that. I'm anxious to see it.
So just to take a quick little detour, remember we talked about my buddy at the end of a podcast three-ish or so episodes ago. I'm pretty confident that he had some sort of problem with his poly, and not that he lied. He just was nervous. Whatever showed up, that caused them to come visit, scrutinize him, where they did find something that was completely unrelated, and that's why he got jammed up. I'm pretty sure that's how it went down, and I'm just saying that to confirm the story that you've just already described and push back against him saying that failed polygraphs. He didn't fail a polygraph. He had some sort of meters registering that he was whatever, not lying, just nervous, whatever it showed. But that's why they came in and tossed the house.
In terms of the question about Vermont, they do have one of the less obnoxious registries in the country. Whether the feds will let you go there, I can't answer that. It's going to depend on the judicial district where the federal judicial district where you were convicted and what their policy is on letting people move to other states. It would be an okay state to live in. If they would let you move, they're going to require you have connections to that state. You should be able to support yourself. You just don't get to state shop and say, gee, I'd like to go to a better state. But yes, they very well could let you go there, but I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. I think that's everything from this letter. All right, then let us move on to, I think this is question number three. Did I say that right? Yes, question three. It says, to whom it may concern, same as the last one. I'm writing you to request information and assistance from you in the following. I am sentenced to 2 lifetime probation terms, and the Arizona Probation Department won't help me succeed. Could you please provide me with a listing of states that are lenient and will work with me to get off probation in a reasonable time? I get out of prison July 9th, 21, so can you please send it to the following address, blah, blah, blah. That's kind of a demanding letter, Larry, but what is 2 lifetime probation terms? Like, he has two, is that like lifetime sentences of probation?
Yes, and what I put this in here for one particular reason. I will be able to emphasize that you cannot state shop to reduce your sentence. Arizona imposed that sentence. Only Arizona can modify that sentence. Wouldn't it be a great country if you could be sentenced to lifetime in one state and you could go to another state and they could say, we really don't care for this sentence. We're going to reduce it. Wouldn't it be a fantastic setup? Well, what would the moving business be like? Whatever state that you would be allowed to transfer to, assuming that they would take you, and I don't have a list of the lenient states, but you're going to need connections. As I said on the previous segment, you're going to need connections to those states that you're interested in moving to. They have to decide that they will accept you, and you will go to those states with lifetime probation. There's nothing that state can do about it. Now, the only thing they can do is after a period of time of successful supervision, if they were so inclined, they could recommend to Arizona that it be reduced or that you be discharged. Very few supervising authorities will make that recommendation. And I think, Andy, you could explain to us why they wouldn't make that recommendation. It has happened, I think, once since I've been in this business. We know who it happened to from North Carolina that had a sentence of 50 years from Virginia. And the North Carolina people recommended that he be released. But it seldom happens. But it could happen. That's what would get your Arizona probation term reduced. But otherwise, you can't go to another state and they reduce your probation. Wouldn't that be great?
That would be. The only equivalent that I can think of is that people go visit other countries and they tell what the situation is here. And then they're like, don't worry about that here. And I know that that's after sentence and all that stuff. So it's not quite the same thing. You're not getting your sentence reduced. But other countries look at what we're doing here and they're like, not appalled. They're completely disagreeable to what we're doing and think their situation is different there. But not within the states, I don't imagine, because then everybody would just move around and you'd have this packing of PFRs in those states.
Absolutely.
Okay, question number 4. It says, hello, Andy and Larry. As always, I can't thank you guys enough for what you do every week. I've asked questions before regarding issues with PFRs. My question this evening is when it comes to the First Amendment and registration requirements. Recently, I went to go to do the dreaded annual registration. I noticed they seem aggressive about the internet and social media identity issue. As here in this state, one of the requirements is giving your internet information, social media, to the government. I'm not an expert at this, but isn't this a clear violation of the First Amendment? The very idea of having to reveal your internet identity to the government would chill free speech, as have been quoted. On top of this, probation is the state has a blanket ban on social media. Why aren't there more challenges on this issue when it appears to be a very clear win? It seems that something gets ruled unconstitutional in one circuit, but another ignores it. I'm in the fourth, by the way, and even within this circuit, I believe this has been ruled unconstitutional. It's frustrating because the law enforcement seems to show blatant disregard. Is there anything Narsal or affiliates are looking into on this issue? I hope this makes sense in the show this evening, or I hope that this makes it into the show this evening. Thanks, West. Thanks. That's the end of that. Sorry. Yeah, thanks.
So, well, the problem is that the courts are not, there's no Supreme Court of the United States decision on this, and the statutes support what they're doing. The Congress passed the Keep the Internet Devoid of Sexual Predators Act back in 2008. So we're talking about 13 years ago. And that was intended to make it easy to identify and remove registrants from social networking websites. And therefore, as a part of the dreaded Adam Walsh Act, AWA, compliance, one of the things the states are supposed to be doing is asking for that information. And then there's a data bank that social media can access to see if your identifiers are in that data bank, and then they use that to eject you from their platforms. We don't know yet whether it's unconstitutional because the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in. Within a circuit, we still don't know. If a circuit decision comes out, say for example the 10th circuit, if my circuit were to say that you couldn't collect the identifiers, all the states in this vast circuit may have laws that say that you should collect it. They're not going to magically stop doing that until someone in that particular state litigates it and they cite to that binding decision from the 10th circuit. So if the decision of the 10th circuit says, as related to an Oklahoma challenge, that you can't collect Oklahoma's law is unconstitutional, that doesn't mean New Mexico's is, or Utah's is, or Colorado's law is. But you would argue that that is binding if they're requiring the same thing, and you would probably get the same outcome, but you're going to have to file a case in the district court at the trial court level, and you're going to have to cite to that decision. Law enforcement doesn't just magically turn things off because of us. They don't even, oftentimes they don't even know about the decisions, but they don't care if they do know about them. They're not going to stop doing this because the law tells them to do it.
Well, okay. But the First Amendment has something in there of if it would chill you from having the freedom to go do it, even if like a little voice in the back of your head tells you that the government's watching you do it, then that could have a chilling impact on you having your freedom of speech. But is this question only applying to people that are on supervision, or does this apply to the PFR population as a whole?
This requirement of collecting this information applies to the population as the Keep the Internet Devoid of Sexual Predators. That must apply to all people on the registry. So people, regardless of where they're supervised, they're being required to provide this information. And yes, it very well could chill speech, but we got to prove that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you're not on the platform, if you're giving up your internet identifier, then you're likely not going to be on it. Like, that is totally your speech being chilled. It's not like you're hesitant. You're totally having it shut down.
Well, I mean, they identify you now with all the cameras and the facial recognition when you go out at a public protest. I mean, arguably, we're going to require them to take down their cameras that are out in public because they can run you through facial recognition, and then they could come back, make a visit to you and say that you're not allowed to protest. We don't like what. I mean, where does this end?
I don't know, but that sounds exactly like 1984. That book was written roughly around the time that you were a kid.
Really?
Yes, it's a pretty old book. I think in the 50s or 60s was when 1984 came out. Oh man. Okay. But this goes to that the social media platforms, they can do what they want though. If they want to not have PFRs there, then they can not have PFRs. there's currently a particular former president that is not allowed on there, and certainly he's trying to fight it, which could be something in our favor, but like they have kicked him off. Like, what kind of standing do we have to get ourselves put back on if a former president can't be on?
Well, again, this is the collection of this is what's the problem. The platform wouldn't kick Correct. You off, except for the fact that they are able to use what the government collected and run it through a database and see that you are a PFR. They might not otherwise have known, because sometimes I have heard that people, they check on the terms of service that they agree to them, and that these things don't apply to them, that exclude them from their terms of service, and they go ahead and get on the site. I've heard that.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Okay. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. Joining us now is Stephen from West Virginia, the NARSAL contact for NARSAL for 3 years. He is the newsletter for the state called The Crumbling Times and is also a PFR. The website for West Virginia RSOL is WVRSOL.com. Thank you for joining us, Stephen. Appreciate you coming on pretty short notice, I think.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys. I've listened to you many times over the years.
Oh, yeah?
It's great to be with you. Yeah.
Long time listener, first time caller, as they say.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's set this up so we can drill into it a bit. As I understand it, West Virginia law provides that any inmate may be paroled after serving a quarter of a definite term sentence. In this instance, after serving 1/4 of his 10-year definite term sentence for violating his conditions of supervised release, the petitioner Scott Phelan was released on parole. However, he was arrested and reincarcerated 6 months later because the Division of Corrections and Rehabilitation determined they had been released in error based upon an internal policy that inmates who are incarcerated for violating the conditions of their supervised release are neither eligible for parole nor entitled to receive commutation from their sentences for good conduct. I'm confused right from the get-go. It says Phelan was released on parole after serving 1/4 of a 10-year definite term for violating a supervised release. Can you explain what occurred here? Was he on parole or supervised release? And explain the difference, please.
Well, Phelan was on parole. He was incarcerated for a violation of supervised release, also known as extended supervision. And he violated parole. And just briefly, parole in West Virginia, I think all other states, is simply the release of one incarcerated, but you remain under the sentence and control of the DOCR. Extended supervision is not under the control of the DOCR, but instead under the provisions of a county probation officer. The conditions are very similar to being on probation. They restrict your residency in our state to 1,000 feet of schools, victims, child care facilities, and a host of other restrictions. Phelan was on extended supervision. He violated that extended supervision. Then he was granted parole, and then the DOCR created this new policy that he wasn't eligible for parole or good time, and they went out and reincarcerated him. This not only happened to Phelan, it happened to dozens of parolees in the state. So that's basically what happened in his case. They decided internally at the DOCR in October of 2020 that when you violate extended supervision or supervised release, you are not under a sentence. You are under a sanction. And if you're not under a sentence, you can't get good time or you cannot be paroled. And that's why they decided to go out and pick up all these people after they left them go. Some people were out for over 9 months and reincarcerated. Some were out for only a few days. And everyone in the state of West Virginia that was in for a violation of extended supervision lost all their good time credit from that day forward. So it was pretty intense.
Tell me some about the specifics of the case with Phelan. Tell me about him specifically.
Well, he pled guilty to one count of first degree sexual abuse, and on February 14th, 2012, he was sentenced to 1 to 5 years in prison, followed by 15 years of extended supervised release. He discharged his prison sentence on December 2nd, 2013, and then he began his period of supervised release. According to our West Virginia law, the period of supervised release begins when your probation expires, your sentence of incarceration or parole expires. So once you're done with everything in our state, they place you on extended supervision, and that can be up to 50 years. Phelan had 15 years of extended supervision.
That's a long time. I'm guessing that he violated his supervised release.
He did. We don't know the specifics of that, but he violated it, and you don't get a jury trial or anything. You just go in front of a judge. His circuit court found that he violated his supervised release on June 9th, 2017, he was ordered and sentenced to confinement for a determinate sentence of 10 years for his violation. He could have got up to 15, but they gave him 10. Our West Virginia code for extended supervision is Chapter 62, Article 12, 26H3, and it provides that if a circuit court finds by clear and convincing evidence that a defendant violated a condition of supervised release, then the circuit court can revoke the defendant's release and require the defendant to serve in prison all or part of the term of supervised release. Now, what's amazing with supervised release in our state is, Phelan's sentence was 1 to 5 years for his crime, but because he had a violation of his rules of supervised release, he now has 10 more years to serve. Happens
Okay,
all
and
the
as
time,
yeah, I think
unfortunately.
I hear about stuff if people violate their special terms and whatnot. But so as we talked about earlier, West Virginia law provides that any inmate in the correctional institute is eligible for parole after they have served 1/4 of their time. But so after serving a quarter of his 10-year term, Phelan appeared before the parole board, which determined that he should be released on parole, and he was released June 29th of 2020. So what happened after that?
Well, that's when on October 21st, 2020, 5 months after Phelan was released on parole, our DOCR created a new internal policy that established that, among others, sex offenders and child abuse neglect offenders were not eligible for parole, nor should they receive day-for-day good time incarceration credit if they were incarcerated for revocation of supervised release. As a result of the new policy, on December 7th, 2020, the DOCR issued a warrant for his arrest. They said that Phelan had been released from custody on June 29th, 2020, due to a clerical error or mistake. According to footnote 6 from the case document, the December 7th, 2020 arrest warrant did not identify the clerical error or a mistake that precipitated his release from custody on June of 2020. The court noted that the respondent had been giving conflicting reasons for the issuance of the warrant. In his initial summary response to Phelan's petition for a writ of habeas corpus, the state respondent said that the clerical error or mistake upon the arrest warrant was issued was that petitioner was not eligible for parole pursuant to the recently issued DOCR policy. However, in a later filed supplemental response to Phelan's petition, the respondent stated, without acknowledging the earlier justification given, that Phelan was released on parole in error based upon DOCR's policy relative to good time. They kept flip-flopping. It seems like the state could not get their story straight, but the central point of the DOCR's policy was that Phelan violated his extended supervision and he was not serving a sentence. So they didn't have to give him parole or good time credit. Instead, he was sanctioned, and that's why Phelan filed this case to our Supreme Court in West Virginia.
I'm guessing that he didn't really go along with being arrested and decided to take his grievance to court.
He did, and on December 23rd, 2020, he filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus from a regional jail, which is really odd, and he sought reinstatement to parole directly to the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. Generally, you have to go through a circuit court. He went straight to the Supreme Court. And while his case was pending during the 2021 legislative session, Senate Bill 713 was introduced to amend the Good Time Statute in West Virginia.
Back up for just one, something that you just said in there was that he filed it directly to what court, what jailer, what, how did he file it originally?
Well, generally in West Virginia, when you file a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, you go to your county circuit court of conviction. You don't go directly to the Supreme Court of Appeals, the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals, because you need to have a hearing and they need to get a case record. But in this case, he went directly to the Supreme Court. He was represented by the public defender in the state, and they felt it was urgent enough to go directly to the Supreme Court.
That's interesting. Tell us about the legislation. What was it signed by the governor, and what did it do?
Well, the legislation was introduced, again, in Senate Bill 713 to remove all good time credit for any inmate who was incarcerated from an extended supervision violation. And they dated it to the day that the DOCR instituted their internal policy change of October 21st, 2020. They did that by amending the Good Time Statute to exclude anyone who violated extended supervision, which is primarily those with sexual offenses. The legislation became effective on April 30th of 2021 after being approved by the governor.
Interesting. Okay, so it's well understood that under most ex post facto principles of the United States and West Virginia constitutions, a law passed after the commission of an offense which increases the punishment, lengthens the sentence, or operates to the detriment of the accused cannot be applied retroactively. Can you explain ex post facto clause?
Well, according to the court and the West Virginia Supreme Court opinion here, they said that ex post facto prohibits prohibition forbids the imposition of punishment more severe than the punishment assigned by law when the act to be punished actually occurred. Critical to relief under the ex post facto clause is not an individual's right to less punishment, but the lack of fair notice and government restraint when the legislature increases punishment beyond that was prescribed when the crime was consummated.
All right. It seems obvious to me, though, that so why did West Virginia legislature pass an unconstitutional law?
Well, maybe we can pass that on to Larry.
Okay, we're going to kick that can down the road there. Larry, what do you have to say about why would they pass something that seems to be an unconstitutional law?
Well, there's a number of reasons that they could have done it. And if you give them the benefit of the doubt, they didn't know. That's hard to imagine, but they were under pressure, public pressure, that is, because I'm sure there was some sensationalized reporting about the dire consequences that would happen if they didn't do this. And because the law is presumed constitutional upon enactment, and they, more often than not, they win these battles because of the strong presumption of constitutionality. The people in prison or under the control of correctional entities don't usually have a lot of resources, and they just end up getting away with it. But I don't know particularly why they passed it, but they did, and they were shot down.
Interesting. So because they may have believed it to be unconstitutional, and the presumption is that all laws are constitutional until challenged in a court?
That is correct. You don't know what advice that the lawmakers are getting when they're passing this. They have every legislative body has some level of analyst available to them. They rely heavily on the Attorney General and the Office of the Attorney General to tell them. And the Attorney General, being that they're elected, they're not going to tell them sometimes that I recommend you don't pass this, particularly on something as hot as sexual offenders, anything related to that. They're not going to come in and say, I urge you not to pass this. It may be unconstitutional. They're going to say, go ahead and pass it, and we'll let the courts unravel it later. That's just typically the way it goes.
That seems super lazy to me, Larry. That seems just like passing the buck. We don't want to deal with it. We'll let somebody that doesn't have a political career. That sounds like kind of a shady way to go about it.
It is.
Is that, let me, to take this outside of the PFR realm, does that happen, do you think, with other laws regularly or infrequently?
It happens regularly. It's the public pressure that causes that reaction. You've got citizens, and people say to me, Larry, you don't understand. All the citizens don't support that. Yes, Larry actually does understand that. But the citizens that are vocal enough that they hear their voices, those are the ones that matter in the formulation of public policy. We can't measure what we don't hear from. We measure what we do hear from. And right. We know what we're hearing with our emails and our telephone calls and all the various ways that people communicate with us. And we know that this is a hot button item. They do not want PFRs roaming the streets any earlier than they possibly can. They want them to be incarcerated. The average citizen that we hear from wants them incarcerated the longer the better. So they're going to formulate public policy around that. And that goes with anything that's sensitive. And it can go the other way in your favor. If there's strong public support for doing something that's good, right, that will be magically reflected in the actions of the legislative body.
Okay, well, we need to move on from this and keep rolling with the program. What is the bottom line, Stephen?
Well, I'm going to give you Phelan's bottom line and then the bottom line for everybody else in our state. But just from the opinion of the Supreme Court of Appeals of West Virginia on page 21, they said, accordingly, we hold that in order to avoid the constitutional prohibition against ex post facto laws, West Virginia Code 15A.417, which is our good time statute, shall not be applied to those inmates who committed the underlying crimes for which they are incarcerated. Pursuant to West Virginia Code 6212.26, which is our extended supervision statute, prior to April 30th, 2021. The effective date of this statute, regardless of any contrary language contained therein. In light of this holding, we conclude that Senate Bill 713 and West Virginia Code 15A.417, as amended, may not be applied to the petitioner, Phelan, in this case, whose underlying offense was committed in 2010. To preclude him from being granted commutation from a sentence for good conduct in accordance with that statute. So Phelan was then eligible for parole immediately. The bottom line for everybody else in West Virginia, and this was a 3-2 decision by our Supreme Court, was that those with offense dates, not conviction dates, prior to April 30th, 2021, will still get good time credit if they're incarcerated for a violation of extended supervision. From April 30th, 2021 forward, if you commit a sexual offense in West Virginia and are convicted and then you violate extended supervision, you will not get any good time credit. You're going to do, like, for example, in Phelan's case, all 10 years. And you still will be eligible for parole at one quarter of your sentence, but you're not going to get any good time credit. So it's not a good thing from here on out, but it is a good thing for those of us that were previously sentenced.
Do you guys have activity in the legislature that would have advocated for this to try and kill it before it would have passed?
Well, we didn't know about it. This actually slipped through the cracks. They did see nothing's mentioned in the legislation about sex offenders. It only affected extended supervision, and that's how they slid this in there. Because the only people that have extended supervision in West Virginia, for the most part, is sex offenders. Some people that have child abuse claims, but the majority, thousands, are those with extended supervision. So we'll be on the lookout from here on out, but we missed this one, and we didn't get to duke it out with them before they passed it.
I'm guessing, because I know how big the West Virginia group there, the Narsal affiliate is. There's hundreds of you. I'm surprised that it passed, slipped through the cracks.
It did, but and we track everything, anything that comes out with any of the sex laws, etc. But frankly, we were not looking for them to just exclude those with extended supervision. It's a tough law. I mean, it really is.
You missed your cue to say that there aren't hundreds of people in West Virginia. There aren't even 100 people that live in West Virginia.
Well, we're just all spread out. It looks like there's hardly anybody here.
Anything else before we dip out?
No, I really appreciate joining you guys today. And again, if anybody has any questions or anything and they want to look at our site, it's wvrsol.org. .com, I believe it is. WVROSOL.com.
Thank you so much for joining us again on short notice. I really appreciate you being here.
You're welcome. Have a good night, guys.
Thanks. I think we can go over to Colorado real quick. Is that where we should go?
Yep, and we got a lot to cover on Colorado, so let's do it.
All right, we're already at an hour, so this is going to run a little bit long. I will read very quickly. You people put this case in the from the Colorado Court of Appeals called People versus Landis. Let me set it up. Defendant Christopher David Landis appealed his probationary sentence for attempted sexual assault on a child. He argued that the conditions of his probation restricting the use of the internet and social media violate the governing Colorado statutory scheme and his right to free speech under the United States and Colorado constitutions. He argued that the Supreme Court's decision in Packingham versus North Carolina would make such a probationary condition unconstitutional. Larry, did he win?
No, he did not.
Oh, surprise.
The court stated, while we fully acknowledge to date, the internet has become one of the most important places, if not the most important place for people to exchange views and ideas. Under the circumstances here, we disagree with both of Landis's contentions.
I've always heard horror stories from Colorado in terms of how tough things are there. I'm not sure now after reading this case, it says, according to the affidavit of probable cause for arrest, Landis sexually assaulted his stepdaughter when she was 10 years old. The evidence included his admission to police that he touched the victim's parts. The prosecution charged Landis with sexual assault on a child and sexual assault on a child by one in a position of trust. He pleaded guilty to an added count of attempted sexual assault on a child, and the original charges were dismissed. The party stipulated to a sentence to probation. Wow, that does not seem too harsh of a sentence. And the party stipulated to probation. Wow, Larry, can you believe that? Why would they stipulate to only probation?
Well, we can only speculate. It could be that the trial court had ruled favorably on a suppression motion, that his confession was not admissible. It could be that the witness that would have testified was deemed not credible by the prosecution. They could have said, we got problems with our witness. Or it could be he was well-connected with people in power. I really don't have any idea, but it does seem like a very good outcome.
Jen in chat says probation there is awful. At the sentencing hearing, the prosecutor agreed with recommendation in the pre-sentence investigation report that the district court sentenced Landis to PFR intensive supervision probation, SOISP, and require him to comply with the standard additional conditions of probation for an adult sex offenders, the standard conditions, and the recommendation in the sex offense specific evaluation, SOSE. Is it the sex offense specific evaluation that caused problems for Landis?
It did, ultimately, but it was the two standard conditions that were underlying the issue. The district court sentenced him to 7 years, as you said, SOISP. As for the two standard conditions, restricting use of the internet and social media, the court required Landis to comply with those conditions, but modified them to allow for such use of the internet as required by his employment at the electronics installation company where he worked.
Okay, I see that. All right, Landis argued, among other things, that he should not be required to comply with the two standard conditions prohibiting the use of the internet and social media without prior approval from his probation officer. He emphasized that he is required to use the internet in his ongoing employment at an electronics installation company. He also argued that the conditions violate his constitutional rights based on Packingham versus North Carolina from 2017, which invalidated a statute creating new felony offense for violation of post-custodial restrictions on sex offender access to social media.
Yep, he did do that. He contended that the district court abused its discretion by imposing the probation conditions at issue because they were not reasonably related to his rehabilitation and the purposes of probation under relevant Colorado law. And I've used these terms over the years, and individual tailoring is so important. And Yeah, I don't know what happened here, but that was supposed to be your line, and
That
it
was
turned
my
out
line.
that it's incorrectly. But let's start with relevant points. Probation is a privilege, not a right. And the Colorado court cited People versus Smith from a 2014 case in Colorado. It's an alternative, relying on Smith, it's an alternative to prison and it's intended to be rehabilitative. If an offender seeks a probationary sentence as an alternative to prison, he or she must accept district court's conditions of probation. That's the opinion on page four.
Okay. And CRS, what is CRS, Larry? I didn't see
Colorado
that as an
Revised
acronym.
Statutes.
Ah, Colorado Revised Statutes, section 18-1.32-204. That's 18-1.3-204. Paragraph 2, maybe? Lists the various conditions of probation that a district court may impose, which includes a catch-all for any other conditions reasonably related to the defendant's rehabilitation and the purposes of probation. The appeals court may have concluded that these conditions are reasonably related. What is the legal standard there, Larry?
Well, for him to overturn his conditions, it's abuse of discretion. And the court relied on a decision called People versus Brockelman from 1997. And I'm going to read it. It says, we conclude from our evaluation of the five Brockelman factors that the probation conditions at issue restricting Landis's use of the internet and social media are reasonably related to his rehabilitation and the purposes of probation. First, the conditions are reasonably related to Landis's underlying offense. Now, to be sure, Landis did not use the internet in attempting to sexually assault his stepdaughter. However, he engaged in sexual conduct with a child, and it was reasonable to place restrictions on Landis' use of the medium that could easily be used to facilitate contact with children.
All right. Well, now I'm starting to see the picture there. I recall that the PFR specific evaluation, according to the SOSE, objective testing indicated that Landis's highest sexual interest is toward juvenile females. It also concluded that he was in high denial regarding his offense. The SOSE recommended that he be monitored carefully while in the community and not have contact with the victim or with anyone under the age of 18.
That is, in fact, you're correct. And that was a significant point for the court. And that is one of the reasons, among others, that Packingham did not carry the day for him.
I can't even imagine, like, this doesn't seem like one of those poster child cases that we should try to ring up the flagpole of someone that had, this seems kind of like a gross case to try and run up and challenge with. This doesn't seem like the right one to do.
Sometimes we're stuck with what our clients want us to do.
All right, so the Supreme Court specifically pointed out that in Packingham, that of importance to the court was the troubling fact that North Carolina law imposes severe restrictions on persons who already have served their sentence and are no longer subject to the supervision of the criminal justice system. The Supreme Court repeated that same point soon after, concluding that it is unsettling to suggest that only a limited set of websites can be used, even by persons who have completed their sentences. We need to get out of this one. What did the Colorado Court of Appeals decide?
Well, I'm going to read again. We conclude that Packingham is distinguishable on that basis, as you just said. Unlike the defendant in Packingham, Landis is quite obviously still serving his probationary sentence for a sexual-related offense. They went on to say, quote, as the United States Supreme Court held the United States versus Knights, inherent in the very nature of probation is that probationers do not enjoy the absolute liberty to which every citizen is entitled. And that's in the opinion on page 13. I say that over and over again. You have a diminished expectation of liberty. You do not have the same privileges that a regular citizen. You are paying a debt while you're on probation. You're being punished. Things can be done to a person who's being punished that cannot be done to a regular citizen.
The analogy that seems to make sense to me, at least it works for me, is when you go get a new job, you often have something of a 90-day probation period. You've agreed to it, your employer agrees to it, and if for some reason they just don't see that you're a fit, they just can you without really any questions asked. I don't know about state laws of labor laws, whatever, but that seems to be something that is in place. So you're on a probationary period and they can you because they don't like how you dress one day.
Correct.
But Larry, I'm still confused though, because the way that they say this is that he, while he can be banned from the internet, yet the court recognized that the internet is so integral to the modern world. That seems conflicting.
Well, a little bit to me as well. But then they say that there are ample alternatives, and quoting again, the probation conditions that issue still leave ample channels of communication for Landis to engage in everyday life. For example, Landis may still communicate in person, communicate over the telephone. Who communicates over the telephone? Receive news from television and newspapers and write to his government representatives. That's on page 18 of the opinion. So they are not on real solid ground here. But as I've said, legal people, legal minds can disagree. I said when Packingham came out that folks don't imagine that this is all encompassing to everybody, because this was for people who had paid their debt in full to society and who were merely being subjected to a civil regulatory scheme. They're supposed to have, in my view, the liberties that everyone enjoys. This is a person who has this, not the same expectations of liberty interest, because they're being punished. Now, I remember shortly after Packingham, the West Virginia Supreme Court, they agreed with Landis. If he had just committed this crime in West Virginia, he would have the protection of that Supreme Court ruling, because they said the opposite of what the Colorado Court of Appeals had. So I think this case will probably be petitioned. There'll be a petition to the Colorado Supreme Court asking them, and it could even go higher. But we don't know yet whether or not this is something that you could apply. The Supreme Court didn't, that wasn't the issue before them. And we don't know if a person under probation supervision or parole supervision or any type of supervision has the right to be on the internet.
As I recall the facts of Packingham, where he made a religious claim on Facebook, I know it was under a pseudonym, an alias name, but making that really puts you squarely on the First Amendment, especially with this conservative Supreme Court. If that went up, oh my God, they would totally rule in favor of religious freedom. But he was just on, he was past supervision. So like, he seemed like a really good case for the Packingham case. This seems like the exact opposite.
It does. And they've got basis for they narrowly tailor this. They're using the SOSE, the evaluation, to justify this is exactly what we say we're for narrow tailoring and for reasonably related to the underlying offense and the offender characteristics. That's what they say here, that they did tailor this to him based on his evaluation. And we'll just have to see. But I don't think that's going to be the end of this case. I think he's going to continue fighting, and we'll have to see what happens.
Final question before we head out here. Doesn't that sound like a bad idea? Doesn't that present us with potentially a slam dunk negative, like a defeat on this type of case?
Potentially it could if it were to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, but I suspect the Colorado Supreme Court was going to be the final say on this. You eventually run out of money.
Okay. Wow, that's frightening. Okay. Larry, we are like super duper over time. We're like as long as we were last week or the week before. Is there anything else before we get out? We got to announce a new patron and then we can scoot out. Anything else?
We got a new subscriber whose name's escaping me, but I believe he was in Maryland, and we'll make sure we get you announced next week. But we did get a new subscriber to the transcript.
Okay. And then we also have a new patron named Jacob, and I can't thank you enough. I appreciate it so very much. And make sure you sign up for the Patreon feed so that you get these as soon as I release them. And as you will know, if you're not a patron, you will have received this on Saturday night. I got to edit this thing tonight because I'm heading out of town again. I'll be out of town today and I'm out of town tomorrow. Anyway, leaving, going on a long drive tomorrow. But Jacob, thank you again so very much. Larry, anything else?
Did he come in at the $1,400 level?
It was really, really close. I'm serious. He was very generous. I forgot to send you a screenshot of it, but it was very nice. And I appreciate it very much. Thank you, Jacob. We're at 89, Larry, so we're not 11 away from 100. I got to start getting my reeds ready for my saxophone.
And the person who subscribed, I'm going to follow up on that question. We're going to talk more about hearsay evidence. I'm going to try to have Ashley in the coming week or two to explain exceptions to hearsay.
Okay. Very good. Find all the show notes over at registrymatters.co. There'll be transcripts there. You can sign up for an email. I don't ever push the email. If you want to get an email when this thing comes out, be sure to sign up for the email notifications. And certainly leave voicemail like Jeff does over at 747-227-4477. Email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, as we just said, just like Jacob, support us over on Patreon at patreon.com/registrymatters. Search for us over on Twitter, Facebook too. And then also sign up and like us and share and subscribe on YouTube as well. Larry, I don't have anything else. I think that covers it all, and we will get out of here. Have a great night and a great weekend. And I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for having me.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.